This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at weightwatchers.com.
The existentialists also adopted that viewpoint. They were concerned with the quality of subjective experience. Not that they were ignoring the reality of objective experience, but they were concerned with the reality of subjective experience. And they're also more focused on action than on statement or belief. Because here's something to think about. You can think about this for a very long time. If you're trying to understand what someone believes, even if you're trying to analyze their representations of the world, should you pay attention to how they act or what they say? And that's a profound question, even from a neurological perspective or a neuropsychological perspective, because the memory system that you use to represent what you say that you believe is not the same memory system that you use to embody your knowledge about action. So it's akin, I would say, to the distinction between telling someone how to ride a bike and knowing how to ride a bike. Those are not the same things. The descriptions don't even really lay very well on top of one another, because you don't actually know how you ride a bike. You just know how to do it. It's built into your physiology, right? It's a skill. And that's called procedural memory. And procedural memory is the same kind of memory that basically structures your perceptions. It's not that you can't orient your perceptions consciously, because you can, but once you've oriented them consciously, say towards some goal, it's automatic procedures that take over, because you really don't know how it is that you organize your senses so that you can pay attention. You just know how to do it. Now, the existentialists believed that actions spoke louder than words, and that if you were interested in belief, and even if you were interested in analyzing belief, that it was better for you to look at how someone acted than what they said. Now, one of the things that you might think with regards to Rogers is that his psychotherapeutic practice would be predicated on the idea that you should bring how you act into alignment with what you say you believe, so that there's no discontinuity between your body, that's one way of thinking about it, and your mind, and so that there are fewer paradoxes in the way that you manifest yourself in the world. So the concentration on action is one of the fundamental characteristics of existentialism. Another one is the insistence upon trouble and suffering as an intrinsic element of human experience. So you could say we could concentrate on subjective experience. What's your life like to you? How do you experience it? And we could say, well, built into that is trouble. Built into that is chaos. Built into that is anxiety and pain and disease. And that you can fall prey to those things without there being something wrong with you. Now, you know, if you pin down a psychoanalyst like Jung or Freud, they would, of course, admit that human misery is endemic to human experience. But Freud, in particular, tended to look for adult psychopathology in childhood misadventure, in pathological childhood experience. And he, at least implicitly, claimed that if you hadn't experienced childhood trauma and you had developed properly, that what would happen is that you would end up healthy, roughly speaking, certainly mentally sound. But the existentialists, they don't really buy that perspective right from the beginning. They basically make a different claim, which is that life is so full of intrinsic misery, let's say, but suffering is a better way of thinking about it, suffering that manifests itself as a consequence of your intrinsic vulnerability, that psychopathology is built into the human experience. There's no real way of avoiding it. Or at least, There's no reason to look for extra causes. That might be a better way of thinking about it. And you'd be surprised how often that sort of observation is useful for clinical clients, for example, because one of the things that's quite characteristic about people, especially if they're introverted and they don't have very many friends, they don't have people to talk to, if they're suffering, maybe they're depressed or anxious, or they have some sets of strange symptoms like agoraphobia or obsessive compulsive disorder, one of the things they always presume that is that the fact that they're suffering in that manner means that there's something, not only something wrong with them, but something uniquely wrong with them, so that it's their fault and no one else is like them. And one of the things you do as a diagnostician, you know, you'll hear a lot of rattling about how labeling is bad for people, and certainly mislabeling is bad for people, and even an accurate label can be a box that you can't get out of. But it's very, very frequently the case that if you diagnose someone, it's a relief to them, like you can't believe, because they come in to see you knowing that something isn't going properly, but they think, well, they're the only person facing it, and that means they're idiosyncratically strange in some incomprehensible way that no one else could possibly understand, and there's no way they could ever get better. And one of the things you do is point out to them is like, yeah, depression and anxiety doesn't really require any explanation, right? There's plenty of reason. I don't remember who said it. Everyone has sufficient justification for suicide. I think that was the claim. Well, but the point is that if you look through the experiences of the typical person, unless they're very, very fortunate, and they won't be that way forever, that's certainly the case, that they can point to traumatic experiences in their life, death and loss and illness and humiliation and all those sorts of things, that are sufficient to account for existence in a state of quasi-permanent negative emotion. Now, often if you see, as I said, if you see people who are depressed and anxious by nature, they assume that everyone else is the smiling face that you see on Facebook, and so that alienates them from other people and themselves even more than certainly far more than necessary. And part of the psychoeducation that goes along with therapy is merely educating people to understand that a fair bit of misery is the norm, and that there's plenty of genuine reason for it. And so the existentialists basically start from that stance. It's like a fall of man stance in some sense, you know, because deeply rooted in the Western tradition, roughly speaking, is the idea that people are divorced from some early paradisal state, and that it was the emergence of something like self-consciousness that produced that demolition of humanity and left us in a damaged state. And I mean, people think they don't believe that, but they believe it all the time. And it's frequently how people experience themselves, you know, as if there's something wrong that needs to be rectified. And it seems unique in some sense to human beings. It doesn't seem all that obvious that animals think that way, but people definitely think that way. And so, well, the existentialists basically take that as a given. And then they offer another question, which is, well, given that that's your lot and that there's ample reason for misery, how is it that you should conduct yourself? Because merely, say, giving into that misery or multiplying it doesn't seem to do anything but multiply it. It doesn't seem to do anything but increase it. Now, so if it's bad to begin with, you might say, well, increasing it is something that you have to regard as worse. So how do you conduct yourself in the face of misery? Okay, so how do they present that to begin with? Well, this is from Pascal, and this is an existential statement that describes the position of the individual in the universe, you might say, or the reason I want to talk about IQ, really, because really that's what I'm talking about, is because the best measure of the intellect aspect isn't a big five personality questionnaire, it's actually an IQ test. And so very, very important to understand IQ, and there's a bunch of reasons for this. And the first reason is that IQ is more powerfully predictive of long-term life success than any other phenomena that can be measured among human beings. And not only that, the statistics that were used to derive IQ tests and then used to predict future performance are exactly the same statistics that every social scientist, particularly psychologists, every social scientist uses to do all of their statistics. So you can't criticize the derivation of IQ tests on statistical grounds without criticizing every single finding in psychology that's ever been made by anyone, ever since we started to use statistics. And I would say not only that, the best statisticians that psychology has ever produced are the people who invented and promoted and developed and tested IQ tests. So there's no getting out of it by saying that there's something something faulty about the statistics. So here's a list of some intercorrelations here.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month med plus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Between the various facets or the various aspects, just so you know how tightly associated they are. So industriousness and orderliness are correlated at about 0.4. That's from conscientiousness. Volatility and emotional stability at about 0.59. Politeness and compassion at about 0.44. Assertiveness and enthusiasm at about 0.47. And openness and intelligence about 0.35. So openness and intelligence seem to be somewhat maximally differentiated as far as aspects go. So the average correlation between the big five is R equals 0.22. And the correlation between the big two is R equals 0.24. So that just gives you some idea of how much segregation and how much overlap there is between the different aspects underneath the trait level. So here, let's say you want to make an IQ test. So this is what an IQ test is. The first thing you might imagine that is that you have a huge library of questions. And there'll be questions that could be formulated in language or some other symbolic manner, often. They don't have to be, but often. And then they require skill or knowledge to answer. So here's some typical questions, and you could generate multiple exemplars of questions like this. What's 2 times 68? What's the capital of Georgia? How do you define hypertrichsinemia? Complete the pattern, 2, 4, 8, 16. Remember these numbers, 2, 4. Then you tell them back to me. 6, 12, 15, 14, 18, 20, 22. You tell them back to me. That's a working memory test, by the way, but working memory is basically indistinguishable from intelligence in many, many ways. So then, you know, another thing I might have you do, for example, is I might show you a pattern made out of squares and then give you some blocks and so that you could make the pattern out of the blocks and then time you to see how long it took you, or maybe only give you a certain amount of time, and if you didn't do it, then you either pass or fail. I might show you some patterns. This is like a Raven's progressive matrices test, which is one of the most tests that is the most accurate at assessing nonverbal intelligence or fluid intelligence. So I might show you six patterns, six designs, and each design changes. Eight designs. Imagine a 3x3 array. Three here, two here, and a question mark. And then over here, I'd show you a bunch of options of patterns, and one of the patterns would complete the sequence. And usually you could calculate the sequence going down or across and diagonally as well. And that looks somewhat like a working memory test in that usually the Raven's progressive matrices patterns involve a couple of different variables, like it might be color and shape or something like that. And so in order to complete the test, you have to figure out how the color is transforming and figure out how the shape is transforming. Or maybe in a more complex Raven's matrices question, it would be color, shape, and position on the page or something like that. So you're increasing the number of dimensions that have to be attended to simultaneously in order to solve the problem. So one of the things that's quite interesting about the IQ test, it really doesn't matter what the questions are. And so imagine you have a whole pile of these questions lying around, like a universal pile, a universal library of potential questions that require abstraction to solve. and then you take a random set of 100 of those, and then you give that to 1,000 people, and then you just score, sum up their, you just sum up their scores, and then you rank order them in terms of their performance, and that's IQ. It's as simple as that. Now, you could do some other things. You could correct it for the age of the participant. Now, sometimes that's useful and sometimes it's not. But you could do that. And generally, if you standardize the score and you correct it for age, then what you get is an IQ score. So actually, the total would just be an indicator of general cognitive ability. An IQ score would be the indicator of general cognitive ability corrected for age. And that's it. That's all. And so here's some of the strange properties of that set of scores. If you factor analyze the data set, you'll pull out one factor and a few little bitty factors after that, and that factor will be very, very highly correlated with the sum. So correlated at 0.9, 0.92, 0.93, like really highly correlated, far more highly correlated than most tests are. Far more highly correlated than most tests are reliable. Now, another thing that's very interesting is if you take another set of 100 questions and you give them to the same 1,000 people, and then you re-rank order the people, and then you correlate the rank orders, you get what I'm saying, the correlation between the rank orders will be like 0.95. So what it means is no matter which set of 100 questions you take out of this universal library of questions, people are going to score in the same order that they scored when they did the first 100 questions. And that means that IQ is extremely reliable. Test, retest, reliability. This is actually an even more stringent form of reliability, which is alternative form reliability. So that's all there is to IQ. It's very simple. If you then take that rank order, then let's say you take the same 1,000 people 20 years later and you rank order them in terms of how well they're doing at their job. You could just use income, say, as a marker. There's other markers you could use, but for the sake of simplicity, let's say income. The correlation between their original rank order and the rank order of their performance will be something around, if you had a full sample of intelligence, be something around 0.5, which is 0.5 is a staggeringly high correlation. So, you know, you'll hear that when you hear people talk about effect sizes, you'll hear them say that 0.2 is a small effect size and 0.3 is a medium effect size and 0.5 is a medium effect size and so forth. What you find out if you look at the literature empirically is that effect sizes of 0.5, correlations of 0.5, are vanishingly rare in the social sciences. If you ever do a study with a reasonable number of people with a novel measure and you're predicting something with it, if you get a correlation of 0.5, boy, you're jumping around the room because that's only going to happen like once in your life. Unless you're measuring something that someone has already measured and you just don't know it. And so it's reasonable to point out that the correlation between IQ, say, and academic performance, or the correlation between IQ and long-term career success, the size of that correlation is bigger than the correlation between virtually two of virtually any other things that social scientists have ever discovered. While Nietzsche believed that Christianity, as it stood at the end of the 1800s, was an untenable philosophy because he thought it had abandoned its moral obligations by escaping into some beyond, and therefore damned life as it was actually lived by human beings. So he felt that the demise was a good thing. He points out one other thing, and this is the difference between having a theory and then learning to theorize. He says, look, if you've been raised in a tradition, whatever that tradition happens to be, you have a belief system, whatever that belief system happens to be, and it falls apart on you at any one point, you suffer for two reasons. The first is your belief system fell apart, and that's not a good thing. It leaves everything unfixed and open, and you drown in possibility, in a sense. That's a Kierkegaardian phrase. But the second consequence is even worse. Once you've learned that one belief system that's solid could be demolished and fall apart, then it's very difficult ever again to have any faith in any belief systems whatsoever. So not only do you become a doubter of your own creed, let's say, You become a meta-doubter, which is the doubter of all belief systems. Well, in the step from that to nihilism, maybe those are exactly the same thing. You know, and that's really, you could think about that in some sense as the disease of the critical rational mind. It can saw off any branch that it's sitting on. And, you know, the utility of that is leave no stone unturned, right? You're supposed to question things, and the utility of that is you learn new things. But the price you pay for it is that you're not necessarily ever certain about anything. And, you know, you could say, well, maybe you shouldn't be certain about anything, but, you know, you can forget that. You know, you're going to have to act as if you're certain many times in your life. For when you choose a permanent mate, for example, if you do that, which you probably will because you're university-educated, and university-educated people still do that, although no one else does. So, and you're going to pick a career, and you're going to make decisions one after the other about which, if you're not certain, you can't make, in which case you have no life. You're just a whirlwind of chaos. So you're stuck with the necessity of following a course of action, which is acted out certainty, that your intellect cannot regard as appropriate. And that's hard on people. Why should I choose this instead of this? Why should I act this way instead of that way? You know, I don't know is not a very useful answer when you're a creature that's as cognitively able as we are. This is something absolutely brilliant. It's very difficult for me to believe that it was written so long ago. So, this is Dostoevsky's criticism of communism, 40 years before communism was a political force. So Dostoevsky's thinking really hard about this nihilism problem. By the way, Nietzsche read Dostoevsky quite extensively. He's thinking about it. He thinks, well, there seems to be two alternatives. One is this superhuman nihilism, which is sort of a variant of what Nietzsche proposed, because Nietzsche proposed that it would become the responsibility of every human being after the death of their religious tradition to establish their own values. Now you think, that's it. He didn't think people could do it. He thought there'd have to be a new kind of person who could manage it, because, you know, he's basically asking you to generate coherent and pragmatically applicable philosophical structure out of nothing during your lifetime. It's like, well, good luck with that. You know, plus he also assumed that people create values, or that they could create values. And, you know, that's true to some degree, and we'll talk about this more when we get into the phenomenological end of things. But it's not self-evident, right? Because one of the things you may notice is that you can't force yourself to love someone, right? You can't just decide that you're going to value someone, and then poof, that happens. In fact, you may want with all your heart, as far, or at least with all your mind, to value someone because they deserve it. They've never mistreated you. Maybe you've said you'd be loyal to them, and poof, someone comes along, you're tremendously attracted to them, and off you go, like someone who's possessed. Well, did you create that value? It's like, well, and in closer to your own experience, like, can you actually make yourself interested in something you're bored about? It's like, good luck trying that. You know, you'd rather clean up underneath your bed than read a paper you don't want to read. You know, and you can't just tell yourself, well, I need to read this paper for the following reasons, and poof, it becomes interesting. It's like, no, no, no. Your value systems, whatever they happen to be, are off doing their own thing. And the reason for that, in large part, is because they're possessed by ideas that you don't know about, that have these historical roots, and that play you in some sense like they play puppets. And this stuff is no joke. Okay, so this is what Dostoevsky said way back in the late 1800s. This was in a book called Notes from Underground. And it's about a man who's like Hamlet in some sense. He's a modern man. He's a 20th century man, really. And his problem is he's hyper-intelligent and he can't figure out what the hell he should do with his life. And it's really bothering him. And it's worse than that, because not only is it really bothering him that he can't get his act together and act with any degree of consistency and character, but he knows that he can't do that, and he tortures himself about his weakness at the same time. So he's a very neurotic character, but he's a sophisticated and intelligent neurotic. And so he's run through all the arguments that you might conjure up to sort of talk yourself out of being neurotic and suffering. He has nothing but contempt for his own character. He thinks he's much weaker than people who can just act without thinking. And he's in this pit, this horrible pit, and it's a wonderful thing to read. It's quite blackly comical. And it's a great philosophical and psychological study. Anyways, in one of the sections of this book, Dostoevsky's protagonist starts to talk about alternatives to his nihilistic hopelessness. And he thinks about utopianism as a potential alternative. So what's utopianism? Well, in some sense, medieval Christianity promised people redemption after they died. Well, a utopian creed does the same thing, except it promises it here and now. So that's, communism was a particular utopian creed. And fascism had the same element, although it was... I don't know how to describe it. It was less intellectually sophisticated than communism. Communists basically said, look, if you guys just stop being selfish and share, we can transform the world into a place where everyone will have enough of everything and everyone will be able to do what they want to do. And because of the natural goodness of people, if selfishness can be overcome, that'll be the next best thing to a paradise. It's like it was a powerful idea for people, you know. 80 years of our history was spent assessing and battling out the validity of that idea, and hundreds of millions of people died as a consequence of it. And you can understand why it was so attractive. I mean, still utopian ideologies are attractive to people. I mean, it's hard to read radical Islam as anything other than a utopian ideology. You know, the idea is once you establish rigid Sharia, then poof, you know, you've got the kingdom of God on earth. Well, and part of the reason that the radical Muslims are fighting against the West is because they see what they're doing as a counterposition to Western nihilism. And it's partly because they don't want to fall into that. You know, we would say, well, that's progress. It's like, yeah, it's progress by our standards. And it comes at a price. And also, we don't even understand how it was that we paid the price. So, the reason I'm telling you this is because you don't want to be thinking for any time at all that these sorts of issues have disappeared or that they're not relevant. They're relevant. Now, the guy who's advising Putin, his name is Alexander Dugin. And he's no admirer of Western liberalism. He thinks about it as fundamentally nihilistic. He thinks that its universal application would result in the dissolution of all local culture and the production of this sort of materialistic hyper-individuality. And he's an admirer of tradition, you know, and specifically Russian Orthodox tradition. And he believes that the cult cultures, India, Russia, and China in particular, should develop their own local cultures, keep the West the hell out, and act as a counterposition to nihilistic liberalism.